Hey, how you doing? Thanks for downloading the show. Welcome to Garden Fork Radio. It's Eclectic DIY. Today, Nicole and I are here with our good friend, Eric from the Root Simple podcast and Root Simple website. Welcome, sir.
Welcome. Yeah, it's great to be here, Eric. Good to hear your voice again.
This is West Coast Eric and East Coast Eric. And then Nicole, I brought up Eric a while ago and Nicole said, oh, let's get him on the podcast. And I do what Nicole tells me. So here we are.
I think it was more of a moment of like, really? I could talk to Eric, both of you at the same time?
Eric squared.
Well, I have to say, I definitely miss your podcast.
Oh, that's nice to hear. Yeah. One of these days I might bring it back. We'll see.
You know.
You've been spending a lot of time in the woodworking garage.
I've been in the wood shop. Yes, exactly. Been building a lot of furniture. I kind of set a crazy goal to build all of the furniture for our house. I have a friend, I'm actually pet sitting for this very friend who comes every weekend to build furniture for his house. So, it's funny when I'm here is there's copies of things in my house that are exact
That's
copies.
Funny.
So we call it a BOGO, buy one, get one, and we both build together. I've been doing that for a few years now. I kind of like arts and crafts furniture, and which is sort of unpopular these days. It kind of was popular a while ago and then went out of favor, but I like it, and it's very, very, very expensive to buy. And I'm lucky to have a wood shop, and so I've been able to build quite a bit of furniture with it. It's really nice, actually, to be able to, like, look at an auction catalog and see something that costs $20,000 and, like, okay, I'll make a copy of that.
So are there plans online to do that, or do you just...
Yeah. Definitely there are plans online, and there are books that have measured drawings and things like that. And, you know, the kind of furniture I like to make is from, you know, about roughly 1900 to World War I, that period. So it's in the public domain, and you can get plans. However, I've discovered that if I just have a photograph, and often like auction catalogs will have measurements too. So that and the measurement and the photograph, and I can pop it into SketchUp, which is a free program, 3D modeling program, and guesstimate stuff. And, you know, there's standard heights for chairs and tables and things like that. So it's fairly easy to guess. And I've been able to do that and just replicate things from photos that I see.
I like the idea that you're working with someone because I have so many ideas. And if I had someone on the weekend to do that with, I think I'd get a lot more done.
Yeah, it's kind of a forced discipline. Actually the guy I'm working with, his name is Jimmy, and his wife, April, they're both, art teachers, high school art teachers. And we're actually making some green and green reproduction lamps right now. And April is going to do the stained glass work. So it's like a three-way collaboration now.
So I've always assumed it was like Frank Lloyd Wright, but maybe it's a little earlier than that.
Yeah. Well, Frank Lloyd Wright worked in that period too. And he did furniture as well. The stuff I've been doing, a lot of it is Stickley, which people may know, but I've done some other stuff from that period and some English stuff from that period as well. It's nice to have a house where all the furniture, it's like a real luxury to have a house where all the furniture kind of matches. Pretty fun.
So this is slightly adjacent, but a tangent. So in Berlin, there is a museum called the Gründerzeit Museum, and it is in the East German, the East German part of the city, or former East German part of the city. And this trans woman during the East German period, when the DDR was around, she decided to go around and save all of this Gründerzeit furniture. And I need to translate what Gründerzeit means. I think it's like the period just prior to the stuff you're building. Mm-hmm. And she would go around and get it, you know, it was this really big, heavy, massive wooden furniture. And so there's this fabulous little museum that I was on crutches when we went there, that I crutched to years ago. That was just so cool. But yeah, you're right. The wooden furniture is so fun.
Well, I'd like to make another trip to Germany to see that for sure, because there's actually a German connection in that a lot of the furniture makers of the early 20th century and late 19th century in America were Germans. And so they were importing, you know, continental European styles like Art Nouveau and things like that. And so, yeah, there's definitely a connection. And it's on my like bucket list to go back there and see some of that and see the art of Central Europe, basically.
We were just talking to a friend about going to Weimar this summer, which is where the Bauhaus Museum, Bauhaus started. And that's totally my jam.
Oh, yeah, totally, totally. I've also built some furniture by Gerrit Rietveld, actually, for the outside. He was slightly later, early modern Dutch architect and furniture maker. And you can get a book of his plans, actually. And I have a lot of our outdoor furniture is Gerrit Rietveld. It's like, that's what's so great about this. I mean, it takes an initial investment because, you know, table saw, band saw, these things are not cheap. But mm-hmm. I think it's by far it's paid for itself. And you know, I live in an old house like Eric does too, which needs constant maintenance. So there's that aspect to it as well that it's been productive. But you know, to be able to have like a Gerrit Rietveld chair or something, that's pretty great. To be able to do that and not, you know, pay $100,000 or something at an auction for one, you know.
Now, I remember years ago, you guys were doing renovations of the house. Did you guys end up doing anything else? Like, so the furniture fits better or what? Tell me about
that. Yeah. So our house is built in 1920, typical bungalow in LA. And basically over the last 25 years we've lived there, I've restored it to pretty much exactly the way it would have been when it was built. This is a kind of unfashionable too. I mean, it's like the thing now is to flip stuff and open it up and make it modern, but I've actually brought it back to exactly what it was. And a lot of it was there initially. And the renovations that we did recently were basically, there was an opening between a living room and a front room and we reopened that and I restored a closet to exactly what it was. It's kind of weird. The house had been neglected for so many years that it actually still has the ringer box for candlestick telephone in it. And I was able to actually get that working again, too.
Cool.
Oh, yeah. The first piece of consumer electronics, actually, is this black ringer box thing. That because a candlestick phone didn't have a ringer in it. So that thing is still there. In the house, kitchen is still pretty much as it was. It takes some adjustment. I mean, it's not definitely not the convenience of a modern house sometimes, but it also has a like comfort and comforting quality to it, a hominess to it that's really like kind of makes it worth it, I think.
So you have like the opposite of modernization. What is that called?
To modernize the place. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Well, do you think that it's cozy because the ceilings are lower or because the spaces are more enclosed, or do you have a sense of what makes it cozy?
Yeah, I think the low ceilings is definitely part of it. And then like little things like molding, like details around the older windows, things like this, like it's smaller, but more detailed. And there's nothing extraordinary about it. It's just a normal, very modest 1920s house. But it has, I always find it interesting, actually, when you look at ads or movies when they want, or TV shows, when they want to portray a home, capital H home, it's always a house from like 1900 to 1920, if you really look. And the villains live in modern houses. Oh, I don't know why that is, right? The house that I'm pet sitting right now for friends, and it's a house from 1904, Very beautiful house. Very comforting to be in, I think.
Wow.
So did you watch the new, Eric's going to kill me, the new Perry Mason?
No, I didn't know there was a new Perry
Okay, Mason. So it's the, Rick has gone on and on about this, but I love this show too. It's about the backstory of where, how Perry Mason ended up Perry Mason. So he, but you might really enjoy it for the set designs because it's set in Depression era, LA. Mm-hmm. And when you were describing the house, it reminded me of Perry Mason's parents' home. And yeah, this is all, you know, made up story. I guess it was never written about in the actual book. But I think I loved seeing like the remaking of LA at that time.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of housing stock in LA from that period. And then, you know, one of the nice things about LA is downtown, a large portion of it has a lot of buildings from that period that for some reason never got demolished.
Well, the library, right? I mean, isn't that?
Yeah, the library is beautiful, beautiful building. One of my favorite buildings in LA. If you're ever there, you should definitely go see it.
Okay. So, well, since we're talking about LA, let's talk about the weather. Is it raining today? Like, it's been raining and raining.
Yeah, so I am right now, like I said, I was pet sitting. I'm about 30 miles east of LA in Pomona.
Okay.
And it's normally warmer out here, but I am wearing a sweater. I wore a hat yesterday. It is super gloomy. It drizzled. It has been a really bizarre year this year. It just rained and rained and rained and rained. And was cold for LA, which like for you guys is not cold, but still a very strange year.
Have you read anything by McPhee? Is it Jonathan McPhee?
Oh yeah, he's a great writer.
So he has the whole thing about LA and the mountains being the fastest growing mountains in the world, and they're the fastest degrading. And I am just so worried about all this rain and what's going to happen.
Yeah, when it totally. All melts. Totally. If you want to understand, actually, he's a truly great and really, really entertaining writer. If you want to understand the American West, he's the person to read. I'd say he and Mike Davis together, if you want to kind of understand LA. But yeah, the mountains around LA are actually taller than the Rockies if you measure them from the bottom to the top. So it's really vertiginous. And yeah, and growing and active. And yeah, it was kind of an apocalyptic rain season this year.
Wow. Eric, where are you? How's the weather where you are?
Oh, it's colder than it should be. I'm wondering when I should pull the bottom board out of my beehive. Because it's up on a roof, but it hasn't really gotten really hot here yet, which is weird because New York usually just starts to bake, you know, it goes from winter to summer. Spring is very short. So that's my quandary right now. So I keep looking at the weather. We have an 80 degree day, but then the next morning it's 55 and I don't really want to make the bees scramble to heat up the hive at night. Well, I can just there's a sliding board underneath. And when you pull the board out, it's a plastic thing like those political signs. Oh, the dogs are here. Right. Oh,
there we go. The dogs.
But yeah, I really have no complaints. So it's not boiling hot yet. I wore my shorts one day. I had to switch the Eric summer outfit, which is Carhartt shorts instead of Carhartt pants.
That's awesome.
Hey, real quick, one easy way to support Garden Fork is if you're going to shop online and use Amazon, please use the link to our storefront. The link is in the show notes here. If you click on that, it'll open it up in your web browser. If you're on a laptop or desktop, it will open it up into your app, ideally, if you're using the Amazon mobile app. Please shop locally. I go to my local hardware store first. If I can't find it there, then I go to the orange or blue store. If I can't find it there, then I order it online. So if you are shopping online, use our Amazon link, amazon.com/shop/gardenfork. The link is also in the show notes. Thank you.
So I want to hear about the bee vacuum though.
Yeah. So Well, I do like we get a fashion statement from Eric there. That's nice to hear. There needs to be a a regular thing on that. Yes, so I built a bee vacuum, which is just what it says. Occasionally, I will remove bees for friends and family. And
that have swarmed or that have nested in a house?
Either that have swarmed or are like in a wall or something. Most of the time, I turn down the latter because it's a lot of work and a kind of a big responsibility.
Yep.
And I send that to a professional. But on occasion, I will do those sorts of removals if they're not involving getting on a ladder or busting open someone's stucco wall or something like that. Like, for instance, this weekend, I took some out of a backyard compost bin. And which is common. I don't know if this happens on the East Coast, but the bees, they love the compost bins because they're a dark box with little holes in it. So it's just like a hive box. Mm. And I can't tell you how many times some friend of a friend or friend of a friend of a friend is like, oh, I know this guy who'll deal with this situation for us and take them out of whatever. But often this compost bin situation. So for years, I've done this, and I've done it the kind of it's the old-fashioned way, I guess, where you open up whatever it is the bees are in, you smoke them off of the comb. You can kind of herd them with the smoke. You cut the comb out. You put the comb in a bee box with rubber bands around it, and then you have to hope you get the queen by scooping her out of whatever they're in and dumping it in the box. In which you're going to put them permanently. And then you close up that box, leave it there during the day, and at night you come back and move the box away. That's the basics. It's kind of a summary of how you do a bee mm-hmm. removal. The problem is that oftentimes after you get the comb out, the bees will congregate in some corner, crevice, wherever, out of the way place in whatever they were in, clustered around the queen. And it can be hard to sweep them up and get them in the new box. And I had resisted making a bee vacuum for a long time, thinking, oh, this is kind of lazy way of doing it. But I finally was like, don't let perfection be the enemy of the good, right? And in this particular situation, it was an apartment building. And it was it was Memorial Day weekend, so there weren't actually a lot of people there. But had there been, it's good to get this process done as quickly as possible because oftentimes the bees can be cranky when you open up their box mm-hmm. or wherever they're living. In this case, terrier alert.
Wow. My neighbor has terriers, so I know your pain.
Yeah. I'm housing these parrot terriers. I'll pause for a moment. Okay. Oh, they're going to keep going. Anyways, the BVAC is a pretty simple device. It's just a bee box with a shop vac hooked up to it and a hose coming out of the box and a screen on it. And basically what you do is you vacuum up the bees using very low pressure, essentially, like you can regulate the pressure in the box with a valve.
Very low suction.
Yeah, okay. Low suction. That's what I mean. Thank you, Eric. And you get them in the box, vacuum them up in there. Then you put that bee box, the vacuum, that is, on top of a normal bee box. And there's a kind of a door you can open up on the bottom of it, if that makes sense. And so you vacuum them up. Put them on the box with the comb that you cut out in it, and then you open up the BVAC box into the lower box, and they all migrate to the comb. And I used it for the first time this weekend, and it worked. It was amazing. Wow. I was able to get the bees vacuumed up and into the box. And then I had this weird situation where, for some reason, a cluster ended up in the garage floor of this sort of courtyard building. For whatever reason, I don't know why, it never happened before to me. I think there was a smashed bee or something and they congregated around it. Aww. I was able to go down to the garage and vacuum up that loose bunch and then put them in the box and we were done. You know, in a dense urban place where you got to get the bees out of there quickly, I think I'm a convert to the bee vac. And I just built it from plans that are online, and there's many different variations I've seen on this type of thing. So if you can just Google it, and you'll find like a million different plans for how to build one of these things.
Well, it seems like it might be better for the bees.
Yeah, there's some debate about that, actually. Like, you definitely have to have the low suction on, because you can hurt the bees if you, you know, are hasty, or, you know, they're banging against the inside of the bee vac box.
Okay.
So you do need to be careful and gentle. And, you know, that there's an argument for doing it by hand and not using one of these things. And maybe in an ideal situation, if you're out in the country or something, and it doesn't matter if there's bees flying around, maybe that's the way to go. But it seems like I think I'm going to be using this pretty frequently for this kind of work.
Oh, sweet. That's cool, because I've only caught one swarm in my whole bee career, and we made a video about it, of course. But the swarms around here seem to – we have a Google email group discussion list, and you know, like every week there'll be someone posting about, oh, there's some bees at the Botanic Garden or somewhere, and they're just not near me, and someone else up and grabs them, which is fine with me. So Eric, what are you doing with the swarms that you catch?
Yeah, so let me back up for a second and say something about swarms. I was just talking about colonies that are already established in something and building comb.
Oh, okay.
But swarms are swarms, you know, where for people listening, because I know you know this, you both know this, that swarms are when a colony reproduces, a bunch of them fly off with a queen and land on something, and they don't have comb yet. And those are much easier to get. Like, what I do for those is I spray them with sugar water, which keeps them busy cleaning themselves and keeps them in a clump. And then if, like, they're on a branch or something, often you can just cut the branch off and put them in a box and go away. And yep, that's all you have to do. I don't think I would use the vacuum for a swarm in most situations, because it's easy generally to just knock them in a box and go away with them.
There is that funny thing where I've been watching videos about swarms and reading about them. And then a friend of mine called me and said, there's a swarm on Second Street in Carroll Gardens. And I lived not too far from there. And so I drove over. That's back when you can actually drive in Brooklyn and get a parking spot. And I had a, 5-gallon bucket. And then I brought a hive with one super or one box with frames in it. And I'm walking, and Carroll Gardens is an old Italian neighborhood. I mean, it's gentrified since then, but there are these older gentlemen on the stoop across the street, and they saw me with this equipment, and they're like, there's a swarm over there, the bee swarm. You know, the queen leaves with half the hive, and they go in that tree over there. So go get that swarm. I'm like, okay. And it's really funny. Like, these old school Italians knew what was going on. And there were people on their cell phones. You know, this is a fairly low swarm in a young tree. And I've got all this gear on and a stepladder and a camera, and they're just walking by on their cell phones, you know, and the bees are flying all over the place.
Oh my God.
But it was textbook. I put a 5-gallon bucket right underneath this, it looked like a pineapple size cluster, and I thumped the tree limb so it hit the side, the edge of the box bucket. The bees fell right into the bucket. I walked down my stepladder and literally poured them into the hive. So they went into the hive and around all the comb. And then I just left it there. And you can see in the video, the bees are fanning, the other bees go right in. And it was so much fun. And I'd like to do that more, but the opportunities just don't seem to be there. Maybe my friends are keeping this from me, you know?
Yeah. Well, I'm
sorry. Go ahead, Nicole.
Oh, I love watching. I was just going to say, I love watching the Instagram videos of, there's some woman who goes around, I don't know, maybe she's in California. I don't even know where she is, but people call her when there are established hives. And so she ends up like cutting the wall out and getting all of the honey and all of the comb and all of the bees. It's amazing.
Is her name Erica? She's in Texas.
Oh, that could be. Yes.
She has a YouTube channel. It's really good.
Yes, it is really good. And she has amazing technique. She is just so gentle and just has the right kind of attitude. I'm envious of her ability. And she often does it without any protection on, which speaks to how well she does it and has a rapport with the bees, because it's just like working with any other animal. Actually, it's a little harder than working with like a dog or a cat or a horse or something, because they're so different and alien and other than us. But it's the same thing, where you have to develop a sense of their attitude and your attitude and your relationship with them. And she's really good at that.
Texas Bee Works is her YouTube channel. It might be the same thing on Instagram.
Yeah, worth looking at for sure. To answer your earlier question, Eric, I have a friend who has a urban farm in LA. Mm-hmm. And it's on a hillside with, you know, a fair amount of space around it. And I send the bees to him.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, perfect arrangement. I have one hive at the house right now. I don't know if I'm going to continue to have hives at the house. It's since the pandemic, there's more people home. So it feels like I'm in the tighter quarters now. So we'll see.
Cool.
Well, and how has the weather change affected them?
Yeah, well, I had three colonies, actually. One that was living in a shed, which was not great, shed wall. And then two normal, you know, colonies in boxes. And I lost the shed bees, which was okay, so I was going to have to cut them out anyways. And one of the other colonies did not make it, I think because there was just so much rain and so many days when they couldn't go out and forage.
Ooh. That's so, I mean, we have rain here and I'm used to that, but I know in Los Angeles, you're not supposed to get rain. Is that correct?
Yeah. And the bees we have, I keep the local feral colonies basically, and they've adapted to our more drier Mediterranean climate. So I think when you have one of these kind of years, it's hard on them.
They're like, why is it doing this thing?
Yeah, and they keep less honey than your bees do. I think that's the issue. Like they don't have as big a, they're more nimble, smaller colonies, generally speaking, and they don't have as many resources.
I'm curious to see. I learned this via my bee group, but every spring I ask, I go, "Hey, has anyone seen the nectar flow start yet?" And then all of a sudden, one week, someone will say, I've got one super full already, and I'm a week behind. So when I went out last week and put a honey super on my hive, and I'm going to run down there and see if it's full or not, because I'm right across from Greenwood Cemetery, which is essentially a botanic garden. So I'm curious. It'd be kind of fun.
Yeah, you're kind of in the perfect place for urban bees.
Well, we're cool Brooklyn, you know, Brooklyn bees. You know.
Oh, they're hipster bees, right?
They're hipster bees. I was...
I don't know. I mean, yeah, I guess is hipster a current word or is
no?
No. Yeah.
We're dating ourselves. Yeah, yeah, we're dated.
For sure.
Now it's normcore, guys.
Yeah.
That like is a clothing thing. They wear normal clothes and they think it's fashionable.
They wear aggressively unattractive 80s clothing.
Oh, yeah, it's kind of related to dad core, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm not going to do that. So.
You may arguably you are doing it, Eric. It sounds like from
Okay. Is this my segue to find out if Kelly has continued her capsule wardrobe?
Yes, Kelly has been sewing. She's gotten really good at hand sewing. And so, yeah, she's been doing a fair amount of that. There's a steep learning curve. So, she is right now deconstructing a favorite jacket and reconstructing it. So yeah, she has been working on it.
That's awesome. I mean, I I mean, that, I feel like that's all the rage, is having this capsule wardrobe, like only 33 items or yada, yada. But I just remember years ago listening to your podcast and her explaining that, like, she wanted to have, like, she was on the quest for the perfect outfit that she could just wear every day and stop thinking about it.
Yeah. I mean, it's been a dream for both of us. It has not yet quite been realized, but sort of. She definitely has been doing more in the wardrobe department, and I have, well, I have maybe devolved slovenliness, but, I've been working on it. I don't sew my own clothes.
I just wear the same clothes. They're clean. I mean, I just have the same clothes. I have six of the same thing. And I just wear that every day, and I blend in just fine, I think.
Well, but that's how you knew that you had gained weight, because you're like, wait, my pants don't fit. I only have six. They're all the same.
Yeah, I've unfortunately gained weight too. I think we share a love for Carhartt pants though, right? So yeah. I have Carhartt pants that I really like for working.
They stopped making my favorite shorts.
Oh no.
But they offer Carhartts now that have a flexible waist.
Oh dear. I need that too, unfortunately. I think we're angling for a sponsorship here, sounds like. You know? They ought to sponsor us.
Wow. Well, cool. This is so much fun to have you back on. It's I just kind of brought it up out of nowhere, and I didn't realize Nicole was a big fan. And I just think it's kind of karmic where you just come up out of nowhere, and I didn't talk to you either, and I was like, oh, I'll just email him, see if he wants to go. And well, less than a week later, here we are. It's great.
Yeah, I'm happy to help. Love your podcast. I listen to too many heavy podcasts. And when yours pops up in my feed, I'm like, that, I need to listen to that, because it's going to be positive. It's going to make me feel better after listening to it. And so I really, really like that about your podcast. And also, I appreciate both of your support when Kelly was in the hospital and you guys did podcasts for us, which I really, really appreciate.
That was great.
Over the years. Yes. And I'm it's good to hear your voice again.
So you can find Eric at rootsimple.com. He does a weekly wrap up of interesting links and stuff he's found. One of them is the Killdozer, which we're going to talk about in the Patreon after show. But if you want to get a hold of Eric, just go to rootsimple. He has two books out about urban homesteading. And thanks, Nicole, for prompting me to make this happen.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you, Nicole. Thank you, Eric.
Go out and do cool stuff and make it a great day, everyone. The email address is radio@gardenfork.tv. We'll see you. Garden Fork Radio is produced by Garden Fork Media LLC in Brooklyn, New York. Our executive producer is Jimmy Goots. For more information about Jimmy and the custom hollow books he makes, visit hollowbooks.com. The music in the show is licensed from audioblocks.com and uniquetracks.com.